The following episode of Annals on Call is brought to you by Annals of Internal Medicine. The views and opinions expressed by the hosts and participants during this episode are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the American College of Physicians, the editors of Annals of Internal Medicine, or the institutions that the speakers are affiliated with unless so identified. All relevant financial relationships have been mitigated. Information contained herein should never be used as a substitute for clinical judgment. For more episodes, links to CME and MOC, or to view disclosures, visit go.annals.org/oncall.
I hope this quick overview of these articles from the supplements to the Annals have whetted your appetite.
Welcome to Annals on Call, a podcast based upon articles from the Annals of Internal Medicine, in which we discuss the implications of the article for you, the listener. This is Dr. Bob Centaur. I'm Professor Emeritus at the University of Alabama at Birmingham and former Chair of the Board of Regents for the American College of Physicians.
This episode of Annals on Call features articles from the May 2025 supplement titled, What You May Have Missed in 2024, Navigating New Medical Evidence. This is a wonderful supplement, and in the current episode, I picked 8 articles to discuss as a solo podcast. I hope this is worthwhile. And we have 2 more such episodes planned on other articles from this wonderful supplement. Thank you so much for listening to our podcast. This episode is the first of 3 planned episodes to discuss the supplement, Things You Might Have Missed. I'm going to go over 8 articles today that I think are important. I chose a subset of these articles to fit my experience in being an inpatient ward attending and have previously being a primary care physician. Therefore, I picked things that are less subspecialty oriented and more generalist oriented. I would appreciate any feedback on this type of podcast and this series. The first article discusses ablation versus antiarrhythmics in patients with new atrial fibrillation. I picked this article because we were taught a number of years ago that when we compared antiarrhythmics to rate control, that patients' quality of life was just as good with rate control as with antiarrhythmics, without having to have the side effects of antiarrhythmics. The emergence of ablation has changed how we think about atrial fibrillation, and now ablation for atrial fibrillation has very good results, as we've documented in previous podcasts. What happens is ablation decreases the rate of recurrence of AFib, or as one of our experts phrased it, the burden of AFib. The mean age in the study was 57, 68% were men. It was a meta-analysis of 6 studies. There was no statistical difference in MACE, which is major adverse statistical events. We need more long-term data, but it looks like ablation strongly does better than antiarrhythmics. And as one expert on another podcast that I did recommended, many people just can't tolerate antiarrhythmics, and so therefore they often drop out within the first year. And so I'm now considering ablation as a very reasonable option in people with new atrial fibrillation. The second article is also about atrial fibrillation, and that is the impact of atrial fibrillation on HFrEF. If you're not familiar with the term HFrEF, that's heart failure with a reduced ejection fraction, and that's defined as less than 40% ejection fraction. This is a very common problem, and the impact is quite large. Ablation reduces heart failure events in people with HFrEF. I believe it's also true in HFmrEF. HFmrEF is mildly reduced ejection fraction between 40 and 50, although this article did not specifically discuss that. They did say there is insufficient data to comment on HFpEF. HFpEF is heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. One of the problems in analyzing these studies is that we do have difficulty in defining HFpEF because in older literature, heart failure with preserved ejection fraction was anything over 40%. We now have this new category of 40 to 50% of HFmrEF, heart failure with moderately reduced ejection fraction. So not sure what to do in that subgroup of people with reduction, less than 50%, but not less than 40%. I'm personally going to be talking to my electrophysiology colleagues about those patients. Now we come to heart failure with preserved ejection fraction and obesity, something that we all see way too often. In this study, they gave the new GLP-1 GIP antagonist tirzepatide and had a decrease in the composite of cardiovascular death or heart failure at 2 years. There was an improvement in quality of life at 1 year. So this raises a very interesting question, and that is, what is the direct implication of what HFpEF really means in these people? The functional capacity and quality of life was a 6-minute walk test, which was improved tremendously. But, and we're going to talk about tirzepatide multiple times in this podcast and in future podcasts, we don't know what the long-term side effects are of tirzepatide or any of the GLP-1s alone. And that is a topic that we're going to have to follow carefully. In the short run, it looks like it really has a major positive impact here and really suggests that HFpEF and obesity is at least a subsection of HFpEF that we have something that will help. The next topic is a renal topic, and that is type 2 diabetes mellitus and high-risk CKD. That is an estimated GFR of 25 to 75, and proteinuria. If the GFR is greater than 50, it had to be a urine albumin-creatinine ratio of greater than 300. If there had an estimated GFR of 25 to 50, it only had to be greater than 100. They compared semaglutide, a GLP-1, versus placebo, and looked at the composite outcome of end-stage renal disease, or 50% decrease in estimated GFR, death for the kidney, or CV causes. This study had a median duration of 3.4 years. The hazard ratio for having the negative renal function, the end stage or a major decrease in renal function in 3.4 years was the hazard ratio is 0.75. That means they're significantly less likely to have had that bad outcome. Now, this is a very interesting study. We're using more GLP-1s, and now GLP-1s have multiple indications, and one of them is to decrease the progression of kidney disease. This particular study was predominantly white patients, and I'm not aware of any studies, if someone knows them, please point them out to me, of patients of other ethnicities other than Caucasian patients, that how they respond to semaglutide. I don't know that it would be different, but that is a weakness of this paper, as the authors suggest and document. Now comes a very interesting question. We know that giving mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists such as eplerenone or spironolactone is useful in patients with decreased ejection fractions. There are two studies, the RAIL study with spironolactone and emphysis heart failure with eplerenone. We're always scared to give anything with the RAS system when someone has a decreased estimated GFR. And so they wanted to look at the question, if you have an estimated GFR less than 30, what are the outcomes for heart failure? They had 295 patients between these two studies who started out with an ejection fraction of less than 30. They had 4,160 patients who did not have that low estimated GFR. The risk reduction of cardiovascular death or heart failure hospitalization for both groups was a hazard ratio of 0.65, which is very significant improvement in that combined outcome of death or hospitalization. They say that you can do this. You have to follow the potassium to make sure they don't get significant hyperkalemia and manage that potassium if necessary. There's a new possibility of finerenone that we've seen written about that's very expensive, but it causes less hyperkalemia, and over time, we'll have to see whether or not finerenone might be valuable in these patients. But in the meantime, I'm more than willing to start patients on spironolactone or eplerenone for severe heart failure, even if their ejection fraction is less than 30. Now, this one's pretty interesting, and that's the question of, you have someone with severe hypoxemia. Most of my patients have COPD, but it could be restrictive lung disease also. And if their O2 sat is less than 88%, we send them home on home oxygen and try to titrate the amount. This study asked the question, do they have to wear it 24/7 or could they wear it less? And so they randomized patients to 24 hours per day versus 15 hours per day. The question is, if only having to wear it 15 hours a day, does that improve your quality of life without causing harm? Now, the study only lasts 1 year, and so we don't know whether or not the negative outcomes of not using oxygen would come into play at 2, 3, or 4 years, but at 1 year, there's no mortality difference. We give home oxygen to decrease mortality, and as I was discussing with a group of house staff the other day, back when I was a house officer, we saw severe right-sided heart failure from chronic hypoxemia, and we saw erythrocytosis. It wasn't unusual to see someone with a hemoglobin of 18 or 19. We don't see that when patients go on home oxygen, and we know the main purpose of home oxygen is to increase duration of life. So I find this interesting. I would love to see extension of this study, but if a patient doesn't want to wear it 24/7, I think that we should give that patient the right to use it and cut it back to the 15/7. Perhaps they don't want to sleep with oxygen. That's a possibility. That they might want to go shopping and not have to carry the oxygen with them. That could be rational. I would love more studies on this topic. Now, one that I think is almost obvious, and that is the impact of weight loss with severe sleep apnea. So they took patients with severe sleep apnea and obesity, and once again, they used tirzepatide, which we mentioned before. What they found was a marked decrease in apnea and hypopnea over the course of a year. This sort of says that for sleep apnea, weight loss works because the patients with tirzepatide certainly lost quite a bit of weight. I don't think this result is going to surprise anyone listening to this podcast, but it might be a way for you to make that decision. Now, given the cost of tirzepatide, I wonder whether insurance companies will find this to actually be cost-saving because you decrease hospitalizations and you decrease long-term problems when you have people with sleep apnea who improve. But that's still to be determined. And once again, the long-term impact of tirzepatide is something that I'm going to be following. And the last one is something that I'd never thought of, and I think is important for both inpatient and outpatient physicians to be aware of. In this study, they found that the new gout diagnosis predicted an increased risk of cardiovascular events over the next 30 days. In this study, the mean age was 64, it was 71% men. They'd been in primary care and they had no previous prescription for urate-lowering medication or previous hospitalizations for gout. And in that study, this suggested an increase in cardiovascular events. Now, when we think about it, it's really not surprising because we know that acute myocardial infarctions are an inflammatory process. If we go back and look at the study that gave 0.5 of colchicine to people with coronary artery disease and found out that they had less recurrent MIs. And so therefore, it's the anti-inflammatory process helps both the heart and also helps gout. And gout might just be a indicator of a marked inflammatory process. I hope this quick overview of these articles from the supplement to the Annals have whetted your appetite. There are other very good articles that I'm not going over, and I will try to find as many articles as I think are going to be the most helpful to you, but each person has their own preferences. I hope these articles that I mentioned reinforce things that you were already thinking or make you think a little bit more about some of these topics. Thank you so much for listening to our podcast.
Now it's time for Bob's Pearls. As you can tell from listening to this podcast, I'm very much enthralled with ablation for atrial fibrillation. This is a topic that we've discussed on the podcast before, and these articles add greatly to our understanding. We had several articles concerning tirzepatide, and the whole idea of GLP-1s and GLP-1s with GIPs and even further is an area of interest over time for our patients to try to deal with weight loss and the other positive effects in diabetes and heart disease that these drugs help us with. This is a recurring theme that we'll continue to focus on over time. And the last piece that really fascinated me was the use of mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists despite very low estimated GFRs. We get scared about using anything in the RAS system when the estimated GFR is low, but these data and other data are showing us that it is acceptable as long as we're careful about following potassium and trying to make sure we can keep the potassium under control. Thank you so much for listening to our podcast.
Information contained herein should never be used as a substitute for clinical judgment. For more episodes, links to CME and MOC, or to view disclosures, visit go.annals.org/oncall